Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
He's introduced you to great coffee.
Congratulations! World's best cup of coffee.
Great music.
You win in a wrestling match. Lemmy or God?
Lemmy.
God.
Wrong, Dick. Trick question. Lemmy is God.
Great travel.
That's the dream. It's not the destination. It's the journey.
All things to enrich your life.
If you're good at what you do, people will recognize that.
Now, he's ready to tackle itself.
Whoop-de-doo. What does it all mean?
With some great guests with even better life stories.
Yes, even better than how he almost failed grades 2, 4, and 7.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
You're listening to the Brenton on Tour Lifecast. Here's BD.
All right, before we get rolling here with Paul, it's time to send my Apple Podcast listeners over to Apple Podcasts. Leave a review. Tell me what you think. Good, bad, ugly, all of it. I don't get you to do it much, but let's do it. We had a real great week last week with Ted from Partake Brewing, one of our sponsors. The week before that with Bill, who was out with Terry Fox. The week before that with Claire Pooley, who wrote the Sober Diaries. It's just on a roll and it's going to keep going. I've got some big guests, including this week with Paul. So let's keep it, the momentum going. Partake's going to sort you out with a brand new prize pack from them for supporting the cause. So lots of good stuff ahead. PartakeBrewing.ca. They sponsor us. Thanks to them. Now, Paul Merks, staple of the Canadian music industry for many, many years. Worked with Bowie, worked with Pearl Jam, Heart, Fleetwood Mac, Brian Wilson, you name it. Some of the biggest names in music. One of my mentors who's put me on some of the biggest shows I've ever done, including one of my favorites, Pearl Jam, and their team, which has led to just a countless amount of memories for me. He's a mentor of mine. He's in a beautiful part of the world called Lund, BC. He's on sabbatical like the rest of us in the music industry, but I couldn't wait to hear his take on where he thinks the music industry is going, how to maintain relationships in this time as far as agents and managers and what that's been like for him and coming through the ranks and some of the first shows that he did. Man, do you know that he did the first show after Elvis and the Beatles in Vancouver at Empire Stadium? And I mean, it's a hell of a story. So tune in. Here we go. It's my Lifecast episode 4 with Paul Merks, one of the staples of the Canadian music industry, a great friend, and all around inspirational dude. So here we go, friends.
Welcome everybody to another edition of the Brenton on Tour Lifecast. Joined this week by my very special guest, Mr. Paul Merks, all the way from Lund, British Columbia. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good today, thanks.
Awesome. Paul, okay. one of my mentors and one of the guys who's a huge influence on my life and my music career so far, sending me out with the likes of Heart and Pearl Jam, amongst others, really one of my most favorite people in this business. And just wanted to get you on the Lifecast to kind of talk about the life of Paul Merks and how things have been going for you with the change in music and the change of the promoting and just life on the island now. So you got a fancy new beard I haven't seen yet. So this is quite a thing for me here today. How are you today over there?
We're good up here. I'm actually not on the island. I'm on the mainland. It feels like an island. If you drive here, it takes two ferries to right. get to Lund. If you fly, it's 25 minutes from Vancouver. But it's great up here. I'm sitting up on my farm and loving it.
When we first met, you were downtown Vancouver. We'll get to the kind of nuts and bolts of it, but let's go to the move to Lund. Where did that come from? Where did you decide to kind of take it to Lund? Because it's the first time I'd ever heard of it was Lund, and then you've been raving about it and posting about it, and it seems like an amazing spot of the world.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think you got to go back to where I grew up as a kid to really get to the roots of it. I grew up on a farm in Revelstoke, British Columbia, which is a small town, you know, halfway to Alberta from Vancouver. And so I lived on about 120-acre farm when I was a kid near the Columbia River. And so my days were spent, you know, just in the forest, me and the bears and the creek and the fish and whatnot. And I think, you know, after spending as much time as I have traveling and, you know, being really, really busy and living in cities and all that kind of thing, there were probably over the last 7 or 8, 9 years, I just was really felt an urge to get back to somewhere like this. So I found this area. I love the stories about Lund. Grant Lawrence on CBC's got some great podcasts. Right. About the area, because he spent a lot of time up here in Desolation Sound. And I think it was one of Grant's books that actually brought me here. I read it and I thought, oh, that sounds like an interesting place to check out. So I came out here, checked it out, and found this property. And yeah, couldn't be happier.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss. The lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you find it easier to work out there? I mean, especially given our new society of not having offices or anything, it's basically you're out in the wilderness, and are you finding it's a better fit? For that,
it's really nice. It's good because you know, I can still do all the work I need to do in the music business to book shows, and you know, I have been pretty busy until the COVID thing hit, and then it's been a matter of rescheduling. But no, I can work out of here great. We're on satellite internet, but I found a new supplier and it's working good. And I have a great office in my house here. And so what I really like is, you know, if I'm not working on deal sheets or talking to agents or whatever, I can go outside and work in my veggie garden or take my dogs out for a walk up in the hills and do that kind of stuff. So it's a great, you know, it's just a great balance that way.
We met a few years ago. I was given an opportunity. You were looking, I think, for somebody to go out on Emerson Drive or something. And I ended up, I think that was the first time we had a chance to work together across this fine country of ours, maybe one or two things before that. And, you know, it formed a great, to me, a great mentorship. I learned a lot from doing shows with you, particularly fascinated with your history. Canada, Seattle, with, you know, Pearl Jam's management, Heart's management, just a kind of everything is all seems to be intertwining. From a guy from Ontario, we heard wonders of this space. We heard wonders of the Seattle scene. We heard wonders of British Columbia and sort of everything kind of connecting between the two. And your story to me seems like it's the ultimate connection between the two sides, because you're here. You've had Pearl Jam and Heart, and we'll get into that for our listeners as far as to make them understand how relationships work with artists. But what's the first thing in Paul Merck's brain that says music industry?
Commodore Ballroom.
The Commodore Ballroom.
Yeah.
Famous ballroom, Western Canada. Look it up. It's too long of a list at this point to get into on the podcast, but the great Aaron Chapman wrote a book about it. You can find online. The Commodore Ballroom, you went to see a show, or you wanted to be a booker, or what was it that was sort of like, this is what I'm going to do for a living right here?
Yeah, well, I was young. Hey, the first job I actually had was in England in 1970 at at something called the Bath Blues Festival. And I went there and got a job helping set the site up and, you know, didn't know anything from anything. And except I love music and I love shows. And, you know, I met the promoter there and it was a show with, you know, Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd and a lot of American acts, you know, Santana and Jefferson Airplane and stuff. And, you know, setting up the show, I found a perch on stage left on a road case for the show, and I didn't leave. I just sat there for the whole show. And, you know, no more than I remember opening my eyes at one point in time when Led Zeppelin was on and seeing Jimmy Page not more than 3 feet in front of me looking at me playing a solo, right, with 300,000 people out in the audience. And, you know, you have that kind of experience and it kind of draws you to the business, I think. And so I went back to Canada and just through sheer in a kind of fluke of circumstance, met a guy that wanted to do a show and we talked about it. And so in 1972, I walked up the stairs of the Commodore Ballroom. And, you know, the stairs of the Commodore Ballroom are an institution in themselves. And I met with Drew Burns and some of his partners, and I said to them, hey, I want to do a show. And I really didn't know much about anything. And they said, sure. So, you know, we booked a show on 11 days notice. We booked Captain Beefheart, who, if you don't know who he is, check him out. He's like just unbelievable. He had played with Frank Zappa, and he had a great record out. And so we booked him on 11 days notice and sold out two Commodore Ballrooms on 11 days. And that was the my first experience. So really a lot of what music is for me goes back to that time in the Commodore.
I like how you had said that, you know, you'd called about doing a show, but you'd never done a show before. And Drew just let you kind of do it. So the process now for a lot of these places is obviously it's either run by Live Nation or it's run by a competitor, or, you know, they hold it pretty tight. Someone rarely, they rarely maybe rent it out to a outside of a corporate gig or two, but for someone else to come in and do concerts, I guess back then it was a bit more common because they had to fill the calendar. What was that? I mean, that moment of like, yeah, just go ahead, I'll teach you how to run a concert, or they just basically gave you the room? How did you have to?
Yeah, they just gave me the room. You know, they had done very few shows of the modern era. I think in Aaron's book, he refers to that show I did there as kind of the first show of the modern era of concerts in the Commodore Ballroom, right? So, you know, Drew had been using it for union meetings and, you know, the Fifth Day Club, which was the singles kind of thing in Vancouver at the time. It wasn't an active concert venue at the time. It was very, very rare that there was a show. I think I had seen Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels in there, and that was pretty awesome. I think I saw BTO and ZZ Top in there, hence the beard. And right. There had been a couple things. So when I went in there with Captain Beefheart, that was really the first of what became the Commodore era, I think. And he just said, go ahead and do a show. And we had to figure out how to do it. And I'm still not sure how we did it. I don't know to this day if we made money or not. I don't have a clue. You know? So,
I remember talking to an agent at Feldman when I first started going, I want to do a show. I've never done a show. And the agent had to actually walk me through how to do a show. Well, you got to do this and you got to do that. And I'm sure at the time there was a little bit more info in there than I needed to, you know, for the artist, you know, you got to take care of them like this or whatever. But yeah. I think it was Sam Tuma was my first agent at Feldman in Toronto. And I just remember it being him and Jeff Crepe, and those guys were, this is how you do a show. And they walked it through, and then you just do the next one, and then you do the next one, and away you go. And it was kind of fun. So was it a common thing then? Did you kind of do a whole bunch from that point? Like, that was fun. Or did it kind of have to ramp up? You slowly had to build yourself up into becoming like a local promoter. Is that the idea?
Yeah, it took a while. Yeah, I think that was in 1973. And that was like 47 years ago that I did that first show. And, you know, so we, you know, we slowly started trying to reach out to agents and you know, get the next show, right? And I remember flying down to Los Angeles and, you know, cold calling agents. You know, I think the first agent that took a meeting with me is Dan Weiner, who's was, I think it was IFA or something like that at the time. And he's, you know, I think still with, he's with Paradigm as far as I know still today. And I spoke to him not too long ago. And, you know, he took the first meeting and he asked me, you know, how many shows I did a year. And I probably said three, and he kind of, you know, rolled his eyes. And, you know, so, you know, just bit by bit, you know, we started booking shows, and then we started going into the Civic Theaters, who hated us at the time, right? Because we put the first rock shows into the Queenie, and the Orpheum was still a movie house at that time. So we started doing, you know, the odd show, and just slowly building up our volume over probably like 3 years, something like that, into 76, 77, which is, you know, when I then went to Seattle and started working out of there.
There's what's the greatest era of music conversations, but what's the greatest era to become a promoter? Would you say that, like, I mean, no one's going to learn how you guys learned.
Yeah.
Coming from there, you know, flying down to meet agents and trying to find artists and trying to develop relationships. Like, to me, I mean, how much money are you investing just to get the artists? Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there weren't, you know, Vancouver didn't have, well, it had a few guys in front of me that were promoters and did a few shows. And then shortly after I got kind of rolling, Periscope came along, which, you know, part of that whole chain now of Norman Perry and Riley O'Connor and all those guys. But, It was a pretty amazing time, because there was so much music breaking all the time. You know, there was a time when, you know, Heart was breaking and Foreigner was breaking and, you know, whomever, Rush and Styx and all these rock bands of that era. You know, every year there was a Supertramp. There was a new band that, you know, was an arena act instantly, or like within minutes, it seemed. And so it was a great time if you got yourself positioned, you know, properly. You know, there was a lot of business that was coming down the pike in those days. You know, just act after act after act became arena acts in those early 70s times.
And then people had to, you know, find the promoter. Did the Polestar book even exist then? I don't, right?
No, right. No, there were no fax machines in those
days. Yeah, yeah. Amazing. So, I'm amazed at how everything got done back then.
It was really a wonderful time, because, you know, we would, you know, like I did the first Def Leppard tour of Western Canada. And, you know, so, you know, you talk to the agent and you, with a pencil, you would write into a sheet that had the list of expenses on it, mimeographed. You know, it wasn't even photocopiers then. So it had a list of might be, and you hand wrote in what you expected them to be, and then you would mail them or courier them to New York or LA to the agent, and you would spend hours on the phone with a booking agent going over every line item, like every line item you on every show in every city. So you would talk about, you know, your catering, you've got $3,000 for catering in Vancouver. Like, how did you come up with that number? What do you think? Like, and every line item you would talk about, and way different than now, right? And it was also a great opportunity to build relationships with agents, because you were on the phone with them for so long, right? And and I think I did a really great job with that. I mean, by the time when I first went to Seattle, you know, I went to work with a company down there, and we were like definitely at the bottom of the heap in terms of promoters. But, you know, by the time I left, we were the dominant promoter in the Northwest, and I was probably doing 300 shows a year, and all over the Northwest, into the Southwest, into Phoenix and Tucson and Albuquerque, and into Alaska, into Anchorage, and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it was just a great time, because there's so many great acts coming down the pike all the time, and you could build that relationship with the agents.
Were you primarily West Coast? Yeah.
In Canada, I would. I was West Coast. In Canada, yeah. I would do. You know, eventually got as far as Winnipeg in those early days. And then eventually, you know, afterwards became a national promoter here. But a lot of Vancouver, Seattle, Portland, and Spokane, and Yakima, and then down into not really California, because again there was a dominant promoter there in Bill Graham, but you know, places like Phoenix and Tucson and Albuquerque, I would do Supertramp and other acts through those markets.
So the I'm fascinated with your Seattle connection here, as far as being able to go across work, because you've had a few roles over the years, obviously. Promoter is one. A few roles over the year. Yeah. Promoter being, I guess, most prominent. But how does the Seattle thing come about, like that leads to these great relationships as far as Heart goes, or Pearl Jam, or anything like that? Management. I think you got some publicity you did. You did some publicist work too, I believe, that I read.
Yeah, about I did some publicity work for some types of shows. Well, there was an indie promoter kind of at my level in Seattle, and the company was Albatross Productions, and we were doing sort of the same types of shows. He in Seattle and me in Vancouver, and we partnered at Donovan, some Donovan dates. I think he brought them in, and we partnered those in Vancouver, Edmonton, and Calgary, and so we started developing a relationship, and he became Heart's first, you know, real manager at that time when Dreamboat Annie came out. And so because he got that gig and got that going, you know, we talked, and he asked if I would want to come down there and sort of take over the promoting side of his business and my business and grow it. And he would manage Heart. And so that's where that really started. It was because this guy, you know, became Heart's first manager. So, you know, I was around them at the very beginning of their careers when they, you know, when they broke, right? And, you know, became an arena act. And it was pretty exciting. And I had some roles to do within Heart as in addition to promoting some of their shows. But we, I think in, you know, by 1970, eight or something like that, you know, we did Heart at Empire Stadium in Vancouver, which was the football stadium at the P&E at the time. And there had not been a show there since the Beatles. There had been two shows there, Elvis Presley, the Beatles, and we did Heart there, and you know, sold it out kind of instantly, 40,000 tickets. And and after that, I did a number of shows at that venue. I did two Supertramps and 75,000 people, and you know, a bunch of different bands. And but yeah, that's where the Seattle connection came. It was through a promoter down there that I went to work with, and he managed Heart. And then yeah, that's kind of where it started.
What's a ticket price at Empire Stadium for Heart?
You know, I don't know for sure. Somebody asked me that the other day, and I think it was probably around $10 or something like that. You know,
amazing.
$10 or $12, maybe. Yeah.
Then that's crazy to me, because then it filters down to all the costs. Well, what did catering cost, and what was a PA, and what was like how much was rent? Like, you know, just the promoter.
Not as much as now.
No, not as much as now, at all. But I'll tell you, bringing you through that kind of break of an act would be something to behold. And you had an opportunity to do it on several occasions. I mean, geez.
Yeah, that was, you know, they were and are still, like, I mean, they are just a fabulous live band. And they were then and they are now. And, you know, so, you know, that's where, you know, I go back to being a fan and being at, mm-hmm. at a show in England with Jimmy Page playing a solo 4 feet from me with 300,000 people, and what that felt like, you know, to be able to live your life and to, you know, to do work with great artists on stage. And you know, you couldn't ask for much more, really.
No, it's really, and it's the core of it. Do you still get the I mean, I'm only 20 years in myself, but I've never missed the beginning of any show I've ever done.
Yeah. Well, it's the best, you know, when the house lights go out, and, you know, I usually am standing at stage right on the floor 9 times out of 10, no matter what venue I'm in. And, you know, I'm kind of at an angle where my left eye is on the stage and my right eye is on the audience, right? Mm-hmm. And that moment when, you know, when that connection gets made between the act and the audience is, you know, it's it's priceless, right?
Something I practiced as I was coming through and learning how to be a promoter rep and tour with some other artists around the world and as it's kind of grown. But one of the things I did learn, well, many things I learned from you, but one of the standout things that I learned, I remember the first couple of shows we did together, you were like, always make sure you're side stage when the artist comes off. And I just remember seeing you always, if you're at the show, like most of the shows you could make, but if I'm in Regina or something, you know, maybe you're not there, but it was always like, listen, the I don't want to say old school mentality, just the, to me, the relationship side of the business with the artist is like, if you're representing Paul Merckx, you know, I want you there when they go on stage and I want you there when they go off stage, which is something that I've carried with me ever since that time, where I'm always, you know, whether I personally, it's harder to have a personal relationship with an artist now. I just, you know, spent a year with Rod Stewart and, you know, never met the guy or saw him once, you know, from that standpoint. But the people, production manager, tour managers, our buddy Sunil, like all guys that we at least associate with, are seeing me side stage at the beginning and at the end of all the shows. And it's just something I think it's very important that I appreciate you know, learning that aspect from you, because they always know that you're there at some point. And I've always seen you at the beginning and the end of all of your shows. Did somebody teach you that, or was that a personal thing for you?
Yeah, I think it's just, it was personal. No, I honestly didn't have a mentor in this business, right? I mean, I really didn't in terms of how to do this. So everything I've learned, I learned by trying it, right? And it just seemed to me that, you know, when the artist goes on and the artist comes off, you know, you want to be there to because you can sort of tell, you know, what's going on with them to a certain degree and what's going on with the show. And you know, you could sort of categorize it as some sort of a PR type of thing. And I think there have been, and I've seen promoters do it. And I think it's like, you know, it's like really being there visibly to, you know, trying to connect, and it's like, it's sort of like a PR thing, but I never thought of it that way. It was more just to be there, to feel what was going on, to know whether there was something that, you know, you could take care of, that it was going well, or it was all going so well, you didn't have to think about it. The artists were happy going up, the lights went off, the band started, the audience went crazy. That's it. That's you've taken it to that point. And then when the artist comes off, you know, you're there. And in case there's anything that, you know, that needs to be talked about or addressed, like with the tour manager or the production manager, like the artist usually, by the day come off, as you know, don't stop, you know, they go and the dressing room or out the door, or whatever it is. But it's just sort of being there to feel what's going on, you know, and to know whether there's anything more you can bring to it. And it's funny, you know, like I have cottages up here that I rent, you know, and I'll bring it back to Lund for a second, but it's the same approach for me here. You know, when somebody checks in, like I'm there, right? It's like, you know, I'm there, and I'm there, you know, a few hours later or the next morning, just to make sure that there's nothing that they need that I could get for them, right? And take care of it. It's just that kind of connection, right? I think that's a promoter's job, is to, it's all about making it right for the artist, you know, and making sure that you've done everything. And if there's something that still needs to be done, you're there to figure it out. They're not looking for you, you're there.
Yeah, it was interesting, which I always thought, you know, I was always there. I mean, Eric Hoffman at Live Nation, or Ian Lowe, any of those guys that brought me into that camp when I was kind of coming through, were a cut of the same, where it's like, you know, lots of presence around the artists, making sure that everything's all right. And I just thought it was a really great touch. And it was an interesting thing to see. And I saw that. I remember the first Pearl Jam show I did for you, I think it was in Montreal. And you, I guess, you know, whether you're down there for production meetings or whatever it is, but I remember just kind of being backstage and when, you know, Eddie Vedder had come in, and maybe you hadn't done a Pearl Jam show in a couple of years, but he was just like, hey, Paul, what's up? Can I give you a hug? And just kind of walked through and went to the dressing room. And it was sort of, you know, kids around, like kids at the playground. Like, I haven't seen you in a while. How you been? Like, it's been, but it was just like that. And that just tells me how important relationships are when it comes to that side of it, you know, in anything in life, but in our business in particular, I think it's very crucial for the artist's well-being and mindset, you know, which was great. So, awesome, man. This is really great. So, part of this life cast that I'm doing is about the life of Paul Merckx. So tell me about the life of Paul Merckx right now. Has it settled down a bit? Obviously COVID is kind of happening, and kind of shut the world down a bit, but just in general, you know, what is the makeup of like the life of Paul through the crazy years of promoting and all the rest of it? Is this your new life now? Lund is like the, it's like the, this is the way it's going to be. It's a, this is the way it has to be. It's a nice relaxed approach to life now. Is this have you met?
Yeah. Well, yeah. There's that for sure. It is more relaxed here, but you know, at the risk of sounding very West Coast, which I don't care about, a lot of me being here is about being back close to nature and to the earth and to the trees. I don't know if I can turn my computer, but this is sort of what I look at. I don't know if you can see that, Brent, but
I can see it. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's sort of my view. I'm sitting outside my office right now on a deck. And so I wanted to spend this part of my life, because I'm 71 years old, right? I mean, I don't know how much longer I'm going to be here. I hope a long time. But I wanted to be in a place where I personally could just, you know, live in close relationship to nature and what grows here, what lives here, be it the bears that walk through my property or the deer or the trees that are around me or whatever. And so not only for me to live in that kind of a style or way, but for the people that come to my place here and stay here to, you know, welcome them into that environment, because they may not be able to live that way, right, due to whatever's going on in their lives. But, you know, so right now people that are staying here come down into my garden and take the organic vegetables up. I don't charge for them. They're welcome to come and help themselves. And it's really great with kids, right, because most kids have never had that experience, right, and they – wow, you dig that plant and the potatoes under there. Oh my God.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And, or they're eating peas off the vine and stuff like that. So I just really wanted my life to be, in, you know, going back to where I grew up on a farm and in the woods, in the forest, to have that be back into my life and to try to live my life as, you know, the personal life that I live, to be as much about that as I can. And still, to be able to go back into the music business and, you know, book shows, find new artists to work with, and experience that moment when the house lights go out.
Is this the best time of your life, or is there, or has it happened in different sections? Obviously the kids are born. That's a section. There's like breaking an artist. That's a section. There's traveling around the world. That's a section. But have you looked sort of through the whole process right now and go, this might be the best time of my life, or this is just a great addition to what's been going on in life?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think of it in terms of best time, you know. Gotcha. This is a great time. You know, COVID notwithstanding and all the other issues that the world is facing notwithstanding. You know, there's a lot, you know, it's a really critical time for humanity right now, you know, by and large, right? So it's not all, you know, it's not all, you know, perfect by any stretch, but it's, I'm just looking at one of my ravens is just flying over here. So I have two ravens that live here on the property.
I have to say it. Is that how you guys communicate from London? Send the ravens over with notes?
Yeah, there's a guy up there. Yeah, they got a nest up here. I call them John and Yoko. And they're pretty phenomenal. Anyway, sorry, I got distracted for a minute. But yeah, no, for me personally, this is a really great time. I have a granddaughter now that lives in Vancouver, and I wish, you know, I could see her more. And, you know, and once COVID things lift a little bit, I'll go back and forth a little bit more. And she was just up here for, you know, 5 days. But, you know, my real dream is that this place that I'm creating here will be hers, you know, when she's 60 years old, right? If she wants to, or 70, if she wants to be here, she'll have this. Like, it'll be sustainable, and it'll be a place that grows food and a place that's close to nature. So, you know, there's a sort of a purpose behind this in some respects, other than just to live my life here. But, yeah, it's a really good time. It's a really good time in my life.
The music industry aside, I think all industries are being affected by what's going on right now, obviously. The recovery for the music industry, what's going to be key to this? You've seen swings, I'm sure, but have you ever seen it like this before, ever?
No, there's never been anything like this. This is, you know, it came so suddenly and so dramatically and so with such huge effect. And, you know, none of us really know what will happen, obviously. I mean, for us to be able to put 18,000 people into an arena again, it's going to either be a vaccine or a cure or like a treatment that works. And I certainly don't know whether we're going to see that. I mean, people talk about that and talk about it coming, and I'm, you know, really hopeful that we get to be able to do that again. I mean, those gatherings of people to enjoy music are, you know, I think just absolutely essential, you know, to people's well-being. You know, we've done that for so long, and I've never seen anything like it, and I don't think anybody has. And you know, I just pray that we do find a way through this. And but it's not going to be soon. I mean, maybe it's 2021, maybe it's 2022, I don't know.
So in essence, you're getting a break now, probably for the first time in your whole career though as well. So are you welcoming that? Or is it driving you a little batty?
No, I'm not antsy about it at all. I mean, I'm enjoying it in some respects. You know, there's, you know, concerns about how you're going to deal with it financially over the long haul, obviously. You know, but one thing about being an independent concert promoter is your resilience. if there's anything that is a good, you know, training for difficulty, it's doing that for 47 years.
It's funny that you mentioned the independent concert promoter side of it, because one of the questions I wanted to touch on, it's a two-parter. So the first part is, what's the biggest success, and whether that's financially, and I don't necessarily need you to get into that side of it, but the proudest part of what you've accomplished so far versus your oops moment, because everyone's got one of each, I'm sure. And I'd love for people to hear what your both sides of yours are.
Wow. Yeah. You know, I think all the sort of firsts that we did, or I did, in the business, and there's a few of them, you know, like I'm proud that I walked up the stairs of the Commodore Ballroom and figure out how to put on a show and on 11 days notice, and it pulled it off and did that. And, you know, we opened, you know, things like, you know, in Tacoma, Washington, you know, I was the first person in, to the Tacoma Dome with David Bowie in 1983. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of those, you know, things where we did things that hadn't been done before. And you know, doing Hard at Empire Stadium after Elvis and the Beatles, right? Going in and doing that kind of thing, doing the first sort of contemporary shows in the Civic Theaters. You know, I did Fleetwood Mac's the big version of Fleetwood Mac. You know, I did the first show outside of California at the Queen Elizabeth Theater, pay them $5,000, and with Lindsay and yeah. And, you know, like Rumors hadn't been released yet. It was just coming. And, you know, so things like that, you know, you sort of go back and look at those things. You know, just something really simple, like, and I was just in the Tacoma Dome a year or so ago to see Heart play, and you know, they were just like phenomenal. But, they changed the concourse setup in the Tacoma Dome, which really piss me off because they used to have doors around, like at the far end from the stage. There was, you know, what concourses are like, and there's rooms off the concourses, and there used to be a room back there. And I remember during the Bowie show, opening a door into that sort of one of the dressing room areas back there, and David Bowie was, you know, like right there, right? It was just that kind of a moment. And it's not like, you know, we exchanged, you know, telephone numbers or anything, but we just had that moment, you know, and you go, oh my God, you know, this is pretty cool. This is the first show in this building, and David's here, and he's looking at me, and he's smiling, and, you know, that type of thing. So there's a lot of those kind of first things that I'm really proud of. Doing all the entertainment for Expo at the Expo Theater, where we did, you know, 135 shows or something. And yeah, and I put $1 million surplus into the Expo budget, $1 million plus surplus because of the program I put together. You know, I'm proud of that stuff.
What was your oops?
Oh God. Yeah. Every show that, you know, one of my,
doesn't have to be financially per se as much as it is like, man, I wish I would have done that one a little different.
Yeah. You know, when you're an indie concert promoter, you're going to lose money on some shows, right? It just comes with the territory. Well, for any promoter, right? It is what it is. And I've gone back over my records for the last 25 years. And what I found is that, you know, from a financial point of view, you know, if you just took, you know, show revenue, show costs, you know, I was always positive. So obviously I knew something about what to book and what not to book, but you're going to have oopses. And, one of the biggest losses, and I'll take this into effect, I won't give you numbers, but it was pretty big. I did a tour with Brian Wilson and from the Beach Boys, who, you know, I just love. I still go and look at the documentaries and the making of, you know, some of those records and Pet Sounds and whatnot. And I walked into a agent's office in California, in Los Angeles, and he played me the intro to Pet Sounds and said, you know, he's going to come out and do this record, and it's, you know, he's got this great band. And I just fell in love and tipped, and, you know, ended up losing, you know, a ton of money. And I remember, you know, going back and saying, Jesus, you know, I'm going to lose really a lot of money, guys. I need a break. They're not going to give you a break. And then, you know, being told, I'm going to share something pretty, you know, pretty relevant here. Just send me a letter and just say you're not going to pay him. This is the agent talking. And I thought about it, and I talked to my wife, and I was, you know, still married at the time and together at the time. And I said, I can't stiff Brian Wilson. I mean, there's right. You know, that's, you just can't do that. You know, I mean, there's some artists who you could maybe take a hard line on, but, you know, but, I couldn't do it. So I paid him the full tab, and, you know, it was a lot of money. And so, you know, that's an oops with respect to being in love with an artist and the music. And, you know, I had done enough due diligence that I thought, you know, that I could make it work, but clearly I didn't.
You've had Pearl Jam for how long? 25 years? That's fine. What I mean by have is you've done a lot of shows with them.
I don't have anybody. Yeah. Right? Not the way the world works. And I'm fortunate enough that they still choose to play with me in Canada. Yeah. And I value that tremendously. I've worked with them since, you know, 95-ish, something like that. And
There's a lot of artists that that come through, and I always appreciate it when I talk to promoters who've had an artist for a long time. It speaks to how the promoter works. It speaks to the relationship that we talked about, and I think it's important. Let's tell our listeners about Lund, and if they want to come out and visit Paul on the farm,
yeah.
Where can they find you?
It's called, my place is called Finbay Farm Retreat. And so you can find me, you know, can find that on Facebook. And I think there's a website, although I'm really not, haven't been very active on the social media side of that. I book my stuff through Airbnb. And so the idea here is so you can find me that way and come and visit me. And I love having people come and visit. And the idea of this place is to, you know, to have accommodations, to have retreats here. And I'm looking in front of me, Brent, and I have this, you would love this place. It's got a lawn that would probably seat about 700 people for a concert. Yeah. With a pond at the back there where the stage will go, and two willows that I planted on either side of the stage. And hopefully by next summer, I was planning to have a concert here this summer, but by next summer I'll have a concert there, several concerts probably on my property. And, you know, so it's sort of an active place and some music camps. That's the other thing I really want to start putting into here next year, is to have some music camps here, songwriters or that type of thing, and have it be an active place where people can come and experience what I experience here.
Anything to pass on to our listeners? Maybe a question that you get a lot, but the world has changed in the music industry, but the core of the music industry remains the same. So passing on to somebody who's thinking about breaking in, what would you tell them?
Oh, well, I wouldn't discourage anybody from trying to break in. It's not an easy thing to do, as you know, and as we all learned. You know, I think, you know, find as you've been talking about, Brent, find a relationship either with an act or depending on what you want to do, but what side of the business you want to, but, you know, find a relationship with an artist if you want to be a promoter, and start small and do some shows and just pay attention to the details of what you're doing. And, you know, just really pay attention to the artist. I mean, it all comes down to the artist, right? You know, just try to find some relationship within this business that you can put your skills to. And so if you want to be a concert promoter, it's like somehow find an act that you can do something with and try it on. You know, you never know where it's going to take you. Walk up those stairs to the Commodore.
Walk up the stairs and kick the door down. That's how I tell everybody. This has been the life of Paul Merckx so far. And Paul, I appreciate you joining me from the farm in London. I know it's a beautiful place to be. You're a mentor of mine, and I appreciate all the opportunities you've given me thus far in my career. And we'll keep moving forward to try to make you proud and take some of this stuff that you've taught me along the way to keep our business in a positive place. So I appreciate the time and all the opportunities you've given me and coming on the podcast. And joining me on this journey that I'm doing now with this thing. It's been awesome.
Yeah. Thanks, Brenda. I'm very, very excited about what you're doing. And you know, for what you've done, and if I just might say, you know, for what you've done, and, you know, Ron Chamberlain and some of these guys, you know, a lot of guys that, you know, worked for me or with me early on, you know, it's awesome to see the kind of work you guys are doing. You know, I think Canadians are the best concert promoters in the world, as far as I'm concerned. I think it's that level of attention, that connection to the artist, and well done, you guys.
Thanks, buddy. I won't disagree with you on any of that. I do believe the Canadians do best. Thanks, Paul. Everyone, go visit Paul on the farm. This is the Brenton On Tour Lifecast, the life so far of Paul Merckx. Thanks, buddy.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Brent.
The Podcast Super Friends is a monthly meeting of five podcast producers.
Hi, I'm Catherine O'Brien from Branch Out Programs in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
I'm John Gay from Jagged Detroit Podcasts.
I'm Matt Kundle from the Sound Off Podcast Network.
I'm David Yes from Pod 617, the Boston Podcast Network.
And I'm Johnny Peterson from Straight Up Podcasts.
Together, they form the Podcast Super Friends, an alliance of podcast masterminds sharing best practices, insights, and discussions to help make you a better podcaster. Follow or subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or at soundoff.network.
Hi, I'm Mercedes Nickel, four-time Winter Olympian and host of Dropping In, a podcast with Mercedes. This is a podcast where I interview a bunch of different people. I get the good, the bad, and the ugly, as well as I share my stories along the way. Now you can drop in at droppingin.com or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and YouTube. I'll see you soon.